IsraelScene.com.
You're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And today we have a special guest, Guy Hirsch. And we're going to have him explain and share a little about himself. All I can say is that Guy is an entrepreneur, which is the new generation here in Israel that has taken technology to another level and commerce. And we want to welcome you. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So tell us a little about yourself.
Basically, I guess that the start of the history that probably people will be interested to hear is the army. I was a paratrooper for 3 years. After that, I made a quick tour to New Zealand and the Cook Islands. I did my first diving over there. Quite amazing, that place. Just the most recent survival show was in the Cook Islands.
So, That's right. I saw that one.
It's really a unique place, and had a lot of experiences over there, especially the things that I like to do, which is extreme sports, like all the bungee jumping and the
Your wife must be real pleased with you.
Yeah, I stopped with that in recent years, but New Zealand is kind of my home when I can, you know, can do only extreme sports, because that's like the homeland and for all of those things. So that was quite good. Did a lot of things over there, and then I came back and started to sign up for the interdisciplinary center in Herzliya.
It's a great place,
right? It is sort of, it tries to be the first, say, Ivy League type of university in Israel, in the sense that it builds a lot of, you know, very strong alumni network. It invests heavily in its alumni and try to make it as the, you know, most prominent so-called Ivy League type of college or university in Israel. So it gives you a lot of benefit. You get to explore a lot of things, especially entrepreneurship. They focus heavily on it. They have an entrepreneurial club. They have a wonderful program called the Zell program, which is being supported by Sam Zell, a very famous entrepreneur, in the U.S., very wealthy guy. And they, you know, they go through the experience of building a business, thinking about a business, and then actually travel to the U.S. and present it, try to solicit capital funding.
How'd you do?
I wasn't accepted, actually. I wasn't accepted, but still, I had my own entrepreneurial project at the time. But still, it's a wonderful, you know, wonderful place to go to if you're business oriented. The type of people that go there are very much keen to do something themselves. There are people who are well connected over there. I studied law and business administration. During the course of the studies, I started, you know, I was a bit bored from law a bit. And the business type of things that they taught me kind of ignite something within me. I started my own startup. It was a joint initiative of both a guy by the name of Ilan Schatz and myself. We were the two co-founders. And it was started from the idea of trying to do something with the concept of the skunk, basically. See, the skunk is a small animal, very, you know, slow. Mm-hmm. Still, nobody eats it.
That's right.
The odor overcomes the, the desire of the attacker to survive, because it needs to eat. And we thought that it will be a very good idea to try to use the same concept in passive protection of women against sexual predators. Wow. The idea was to eliminate any possibility to a sexual-based attack using a very powerful and offensive odor.
So this is something that you would spray?
Right.
So
the idea was to use the passive protection idea by designing necklaces or bracelets that would seem as an innocent, you know, object. But then, if the girl gets attacked, all she has to do is just tear it apart, or use some, like, a corner of a table or something to tear the device offer, and then, you know, a capsule will break and the odor will be vaporized into the air. Obviously, the first thing was to try and see if there are odors that, when vaporized, eliminate any possibility to, you know, sexually attack someone.
That's a great idea.
We actually found that there is. We hooked up with American scientists that used to work for the U.S. Navy for many years, doing sort of, not the same things, but trying to use odor in order to control both animals and human behavior. And we actually got to the point where we had the substance. We had the actual, you know, chemical that could have served us to that purpose. However, designing such a device is a very capital demanding task. We needed to raise something like something in the vicinity of $5 million to get to the prototype, because it needs a lot of tests. We needed to reduce the volatility. It's a flammable substance. So we figured out, okay, we have something. Let's try and sell it, which is the substance. Now, who can use it? Security forces. So without exposing any details, I can say that some security forces around the world using that compound to control
or situations, or?
Right. I am personally aware to a particular situation, a security situation in which they didn't want a certain bus stop to be populated with civilians in a particular day. So they
put out spray.
So nobody noticed. Nobody could understand why people are not getting there, but nobody was there that day. That's aside great. From the very specific guys that just had to be there and that they wanted to identify.
You want to eliminate a population from a certain area, so instead of bombing the area, it's possible you could bomb it with a certain chemical which would make people want to leave the areas, so overwhelming that they would just have to leave? Is
exactly.
that a possibility? Cool idea.
I mean, it is pretty obvious that the most challenging That's task great. That governments, Western governments, have today in their battle in Iraq or in, you know, wherever, is the difficulty of, you know, commencing war on civilian population that the terrorists are embedded within it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you fight such a war?
It's very difficult, obviously. We know that.
It's extremely difficult. In particular, when your opponent has no, you know, moral standards, that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that governments are struggling with, and odor is indeed one of the elements, methods in which you can control crowds. Okay, it's not maybe the ultimate solution, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you enter a house and you have a hostage situation, that might not liberate the, you know, the hostages. But still, it can be used in certain scenarios. It makes a lot of sense. And I know that just recently, the U.S. Armed Forces started to use some kind of a grenade that is a non-lethal grenade that combines an odor factor, a sonic boom factor, and a light factor.
That's great.
Okay, so when it goes off, whoever is out there can't see, can't hear, and has a very bad feeling in his stomach. And this, you know, may draw his attention from the other things that he's trying to do without killing. We also managed to develop a compound called Odor Screen, which was supposed to be the antidote to the stink bomb, which is a lotion that you rub under your nostrils, and it reduces the exposure to offensive odors.
So that's what I saw in CSI.
Exactly. Actually, CSI did for free about a 1 minute pitch about the product. Americans use Vicks.
Still use Vicks.
Like
interesting.
Pathologists and emergency rescue personnel in scenes where the odor is overwhelming. But the Vicks has it is not designed for it. It is good for 2-3 minutes. It is mint,
mm-hmm.
So it vaporizes rather quickly. And mint, what it does, I mean, Vicks is for overcoming, you know, nasal problems. So it actually expands.
So allows even more.
So after through 3 minutes, you're going to smell that odor much better. So our product was obviously superior, and people used it. We had a preliminary test with Zaka over here. They used the product in scenes, terror scenes.
That's the folks who go in and handle all the body parts
to bring to proper Jewish burial. Right. And they used it, and the feedback was just phenomenon. They actually told us that some people couldn't approach the scene, and when they were handed with the product, they could do their job.
Wow.
So that was amazing. And they use it today. I'm kind of glad that they're not using it, you know, heavily as they did a few years ago, because then there are not many terror attacks.
Goodness.
And I'd like to, you know, keep things going to stay this way. But for example, when the tsunami happens, so Ilan flew over there with about 100,000, I think, units, and people were, you know, blessing him all over the place. I mean, they just consumed the entire thing. All the security forces over there from all the countries, family members that had to go into those shrines with thousands and thousands of bodies and try to identify their loved ones. Odor, on top of all things, was the last thing they wanted to have when going through that experience. So they used that as well.
Get them to use it at Katrina in New Orleans.
Yeah. Actually, it was used by Katrina. In Katrina, we already had a U.S. distributor that sells products to the emergency medical services sector. So he was there, hand over the odor screen, and again, people used it. So that was my first startup. At November 05, exit the company, sold some of my shares to the existing investors, you know, went to find other things to do. But before I went on to do other things, I came to the conclusion that now, as you're doing with this radio show, is trying to give something back. So this is just what I did. I took my wife, back then girlfriend, and we flew to China, and we were the first Westerners to ever volunteer in the giant panda rescue camp in Chengdu.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Wow, what an interesting journey.
It was quite a journey.
Wow.
First I offered her to marry me on the Great Chinese Wall 2 days, and then we flew to Chengdu, and we actually spent, you know, a few weeks over there. It must be said that the Chinese are very organized people. This facility in Chengdu is actually very, very organized. We wanted to first, you know, show others that this particular animal needs a lot of support. There's only 1,000 pandas left in the world. All of the wild pandas are in China, and they're just this close to be extinct.
Do they need a lot of room?
In the wild, yeah. Panda needs to eat about, I think, 20 kilograms of bamboo per day. So this is a lot of bamboo fields.
Wow.
And with the whole industrialization going on in China, they're just, you know, they're left without any place to eat, and they die out of hunger. Until you had a 1-year-old panda chasing you to try to play with mm-hmm. you didn't experience true joy in life.
Wow,
that was awesome.
How long were you there?
About 3 to 4 weeks, something like that. And then we wrote something for their website. So we wrote about our experience so they can show others. You know, we're still in, you know, keeping in touch with them and trying to help in any way we can. There's now actually a new blog that they opened about the pandas.
So you went on your adventure to China with the pandas, which is incredible. And then you came back to Israel at that point, after you spent your time there? And
yeah, I came back. I then I just started to think about my next venture. Met with a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of people with good ideas and solid ideas. But after the first startup, I came to the conclusion that, you know, I'd rather open a falafel stand, but with the most greatest team that I can, then work on the cure for cancer with, you know, not so good of a team.
Right here on Allenby, right next after Rothschild, there's a falafel stand. I think they're either brothers or cousins, and they opened, I don't know, about 6 months ago. And they're great. They love what they're doing, you know? They work together. They have a great sense of humor. And everywhere else is empty, but there's a line from morning till evening. It's just unbelievable. And you know there's love in that falafel.
You know, you can't do things alone unless you're really, I don't know. You need a team to do everything. So I was seeking the best possible team or the best possible partner to do, you know, whatever. I was open to the spectrum of ideas that I would, you know, put my effort into. But I was very, very picky about the partner that I'm going to do business with. After a while, Asif, who's the co-founder of IncrediTrade, which is the company that I'm currently leading, approached me with his initial idea of what IncrediTrade should do. You know, and after a short period of time, I came to the conclusion that this is it. I mean, because Asif is the CEO of an incubator in Israel, a technological incubator by the name of Nayot. What he does for a living is seeding new companies. You know, he's a great guy. He's very, very talented. He's very experienced in knowing the ups and downs of companies, what it's like to start something from scratch and get into someplace. You know, he wanted me as a partner. And I said, okay, this is whatever the idea, this is the type of partner I'm looking for. I've met him in July 2006. It took me about a week, 2 weeks to think about the idea a little bit because it's like marriage. You know you're going to be seeing that guy more than your wife for at least 2-3 years now.
Well said.
You know, and nobody gets married after a week, aside from some people. Usually it doesn't work that well, but I was confident with it. In August, I flew to another trip in Africa. Came back, I started to work on the venture, trying to assemble a proper team, find the best investor to seed the company. I was very, very fortunate to meet a very exceptional set of people that complement each other. We will provide information to people who are keen to invest in U.S. stock market, to retail investors, U.S. retail investors. And it's going to be online, right?
These are tools basically for individual investors.
Exactly.
Providing.
We think we understand what retail investors in the U.S. are currently looking for. We needed someone with an expertise in the stock market. And I was very, very fortunate to meet a guy by the name of Josh Blacher, who just made Aliyah about 3 months ago.
From where?
From the U.S.
Yes.
He made Aliyah from the U.S.
Great.
He was, you know, in his last position, he was vice president at Deutsche Asset Management, which is a part of Deutsche Bank. And he was a portfolio manager overseeing a $10 billion portfolio. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't find such guys in Israel. They're very limited in number. And if they exist, they live in the U.S. So I was very fortunate to meet him. And that complements the side of understanding how, you know, investors think and what they like, what they dislike. And then I needed a internet, you know, marketeer, someone who understands how to deliver products over the internet. And again, I was very fortunate to meet a guy by the name of Eran Lagon. Then the most recent position he held was vice president at the ICQ, which is an AOL company.
Oh, yes. That was originally an Israeli company.
Yeah, it was originally
sold out.
And it was sold to AOL. And this guy understands internet. He has a blog. He reads blog all the time. This is what all his friends are in internet. That was it. And we needed one more guy to lead the development of the application. And again, we found the former CTO of MSN in Israel. And then, of course, we tried to solicit capital injection. We figured out that probably the best place to go to if you have an idea in internet in Israel is something that's called LGI Lab, which is a joint venture of Lightspeed Venture Partners, which is a West Coast, you know, venture capital firm, and Gemini Israel Funds, which is an Israeli venture capital firm. And they have opened a joint venture called LGI Lab, which seeds new internet startups. And you have the combination of an Israeli presence and a U.S. presence, and it complements the offering that one VC can offer you. You know, you don't get a lot of things like that in Israel. It's actually the only one of its kind. True, you have a branch of Sequoia in Israel, but they only invest in things that keep the R&D center in Israel. So we figured that, okay, the probably the best thing to do is to go to LGI Lab and pitch the idea. And this is what we did. It was in late October 2006. And by the end of December, we had the money we wanted. So this was fast, was efficient. They were very professional, very demanding in terms of what they wanted to know. But still, it's internet. You have to move very, very fast.
Fast, yes.
And if your venture capital firm is, you know, taking its time, then it just hurts the business.
Right.
Managed to start the business in January, early January. So we're now, you know, still in the whole administrative things of offices and equipment and things of that nature. But things are moving very fast towards, you know, completion. In terms of what we will offer, we're trying to stay below the radar. The only PR that we had is just, you know, an announcement that LGI made the investment. That was, you know, in the Israeli press and in their blog. No, this is the just the second time that I'm publicly talking about IncrediTrade.
Wow, I feel honored. What's your take on Israel? What's so unique about us?
I think that first and foremost, there are just an immense number of Israelis that have, and I cannot describe that in any other term, that as an internal fire, a burning desire to be entrepreneurs. They just craving to do something of their own and make an impact, maybe be their own bosses as well. Maybe that's part of it. But there are a lot of Israelis that wants to be in this industry. It's very lucrative. It's very, you know you're going to meet a lot of good people. The other thing is that Israel and the U.S. have a very strong relationship. It started from, you know, the military aspect and the political aspect, but it also reflects on the business aspects. So a lot of Israelis have very, very good contacts with, you know, decision makers in the U.S. You see a lot of, you know, there is a lot of presence of Israelis in MBA schools. There's a great presence of Israeli companies in the Nasdaq and in the New York Stock Exchange. There's just a lot of activity. We somehow managed to work with Americans better than any other country. And entrepreneurship is part of the American dream as well. So, hey, you have
natural a partner.
Right. You have a good combination. The only thing is that, of course, Americans don't tend not to invest in things that aren't in their backyard. They want the companies they invest in to sit very, very close to them. And so they can keep an eye, or, you know, that driving to the board meeting will not be demanding. So there was a need for venture capitals to be launched here. And this is exactly what happened. You know, it's a tremendous success. I think that Israeli startups from Checkpoint, you know, Italics, Converse, employ thousands of people and pay, you know, good salaries, manage to provide to a lot of people. And this is awesome. And this is a strength that must be preserved. So I think the question is how we support that, how we manage to keep that going and be competitive. China or India?
The question I wanted to ask Guy, excuse me.
No problem.
To maintain this strong connection and this strong interaction between Israel and the United States, is there a danger that this will not maintain itself? And do you see or have ideas of how to maintain it, how to nourish it, and how to make sure it keeps going?
Yes, I think first and foremost, the Israel community and the government and whoever deals with and care about Israel needs to understand that this is a growth engine for the Israeli state. It must be first preserved, but it must also nourish and prosper more than what it is now. And I think the way you do it is people aware of entrepreneurship as a career, even at, you know, very early stage. I was a mentor in a non-profit organization called Young Israeli Entrepreneurs. And we 14-year-old students who wanted to explore this process and follow them to you know, in the creation of a new idea and then trying to develop it and then try to sell it. This is amazing because we have no other resource here other than human capital. And this is probably the best way to make use of that human capital. I don't think there's any other way or any sector, maybe the military sector, that contribute to the Israeli economy as did the high-tech sector. All the deals, all the M&As, all the IPOs in foreign stock exchanges brought a lot of money to Israel. In a nutshell, my ideas are that we need to find a way to have American investors, both angel investors and VCs, to be actively and directly involved in Israeli companies. You know, as Sequoia did, as Greylock Partners, Lightspeed, with what they did with Gemini, it needs to happen more and more. We need to attract. There are other good and excellent VCs in the U.S. that we should somehow find a way to solicit them to open a branch over here. Maybe by tax incentives, maybe by other incentives that the government can offer them, or this should happen, and people should think about how to do that. Secondly, we need to learn what are the competitive advantages of entrepreneur in Ireland, in the U.S., in China, in India, and then beat that. Mm-hmm. Beat that in all aspects. Try to be competitive in all the aspects that you can, whether that it's the environment, grants, things of that nature. This has to be a methodological thinking of how to make sure that people in China knows that we are competitive to them as well, and that when an investor is looking where to put his money, put it into Israel. That may also go through the Israeli stock market. That maybe there are some things in Israel that should happen with the stock market to make the stock market itself more lucrative to foreign investors. Mm-hmm. So companies can go public here,
get funding.
But the funding will come from overseas. So the stock market needs to be competitive as well somehow.
Do you think that there's more a possibility of strategic alliances between Israeli entrepreneurs and China, as an example? I mean, in spite of what's, you know, politically speaking.
That is a very good question. And a friend of mine told me that when he'll have a child, probably the best thing that he can do is teach him Chinese. So, again, this is an idea. You know, let's teach our students Chinese. I know there are some investment houses in Israel that are actively looking to fund a joint Chinese-Israeli ventures, and this is a blissful thing to do. This should be a hub for entrepreneurship. So U.S. is one thing, China is most certainly, China and India, even though it's like a slogan or a mantra that everybody say, what about China and India, about every venture? It's true. These are emerging markets, and it seems that their government is doing positive things about making their economy free, liberal, and open to new initiatives, and this is us.
I think to have that kind of strategic partnership with the VCs in America, and for them to truly appreciate and understand that we can move quickly when we see an opportunity in China, in India, or whatever, is an advantage to everybody.
Exactly. We are small in mentality. I mean, we don't like working by the books, so it gives an edge. So even if your company is growing big, you still think as an entrepreneur and trying to make sure that things will happen swiftly, and if you need that to divert a little bit from the usual path of how things are being done, fine, you'll do that in order to get your goal. And that's wonderful. That's how we, won wars over here. A survival skill that Israelis have. So in much as like in the military field, in the business field.
And that's really interesting you brought that up, the military field. I found that, unfortunately, for what I observed, even with the last Lebanon situation, was that up until that moment, and having been in the IDF years ago, is that you knew what was, it was real time. You knew what was going on. You reacted. You had the training to do it. And all of a sudden, in this war, everybody's behind computers, and they kind of disappeared from the real on-time situation, which I think in many ways suffered because of it.
I personally feel that we kind of didn't do so well in the last war because of cynicism, cockiness, a bit of losing the sense of direction. And in business, you don't have that.
No.
There was a study about Israeli combat pilots, about the correlation of them being brave in combat and, you know, problem solvers and quick thinkers, and how it affects their very obvious success in businesses, in entrepreneurial businesses. A lot of combat pilots are doing very, very well in business, in entrepreneurial projects. So this is something worth looking for. It's probably one of the only things that's says something to Americans that someone was in the Israeli Air Force. It's a stamp of quality, much like, you know, a Harvard graduate or a Stanford graduate.
Right.
So this is interesting as well.
Guy Hirsch, thank you so much for giving us your time and being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yoram?
Very good.
Okay.